You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode 21 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast, airing on Middle Earth Network Radio as well as on the Star Wars Report website. Our episodes are also available on our own Facebook page at SW Beyond Films. I'm one of your hosts, the defender of the EU, Mark Herleman, and with me, like the light side to my dark side, the EU guru himself, Nathan B. Butler.
Hey, everybody. Yes, I get to be the light side this time. I'm not like Avaloth possession or some kind of disease this time. I'm going up in the world.
After making you be possessed by Avaloth twice, I figured, you know, you're due for some good. You know, the balance is there. Also joining us this week, Peter Morrison of Lightsaber Rattling, as well as one of our intrepid reporters over at the Star Wars Report website. Pete?
Hi, guys. If you are light and you are dark, does that make me a gray Jedi paladin?
I like it!
I think it makes you the father, given the topic that we're covering here. I think it makes me apparently the daughter, and I'm not entirely sure what that, you know, how that bodes. I don't think I would work well with that clothing. It makes him Sam Witwer, I suppose. And then you are the old man with the beard who looks like he should be a monk in some East Asian or Southeast Asian society.
So in other words, I've got a bad feeling about this.
Hey, and it's Whistler. Whistler is Avaloth. Whistler is the bringer of chaos.
You know, okay, in a pre-show here, we were looking for certain issues of Insider, and I was mentioning how when my subscription ran out, I actually had a chance to complain to them about the fact that we didn't have the numbers on the side, and it was great. I may actually keep it in the bloopers, I don't know yet, but Nathan was like saying, don't hold your breath, and I'm looking at the two I have up here, and lo and behold, as of 1:32, the numbers are back, and they're at the top. On the outside binding. I just thought that was just so amazing. It's just one of those things I had to throw out there in my banter moment of glory.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, as you know, we ask the tough questions. The questions that have bothered you for a long time or simple ones that have just perplexed you off and on. You ponder about Star Wars, and of course, so do we. This episode, we're going to be exploring the series Fate of the Jedi, building on last episode's discussion of Apocalypse. At the time of this recording, the series has been completed in hardcover and is up to Vortex in paperback releases. Consider this your spoiler warning, because here we go.
You've been warned. Now, I was just noticing when I was looking through my paperback, when I grabbed Apocalypse, the beginning had a little page that was almost exactly like the end of the series. And so I was going to go ahead and read those real fast, kind of ponder this, because it literally came to me about seconds before we started our Skype call. And in the beginning of Outcast, we have... The darkness was eternal, all-powerful, unchangeable. She had stared into it, unblinking and afraid. She was determined it would not claim her. She had resisted these many years. She would resist it forever, never despairing. It was unchangeable, but change would take place. The Force said so. And I remember when I first read that, I was thinking, ooh, who's this? And later I thought, okay, well, it's got to be Avaloth. But at the end of the series, I was again wondering when we read the end part there, was it Avaloth? Was it Jaina? The darkness was eternal, all-powerful, unchangeable. She had stared into it for too many years, alone and unblinking, determined it would not take her. Now it never would. Now... she was lighting a candle. And now when I put these two together, you know, I was really thinking when I read Apocalypse and I read that last part at the very end, I was thinking, okay, that's got to be about Jaina. Which when I'm now reading Outcast, I'm like, oh, if it is Jaina, do you think now that they actually foreshadowed that from the beginning that this was supposed to be about Jaina? Or do you think that it could just as easily be about Avaloth and they purposely left it vague?
I have no idea who they meant with this, even if it is Jaina. It's very weird.
I guess I sort of can see how it could be Jaina. I mean, she did sort of veer toward the dark side in Dark Journey, you know, after Anakin had died, or Anakin Solo, not to be confused, because, of course, we know confusion between the Anakins is why they had to kill him off instead of Jason in the first place. I don't know. It seems to sort of fit, you know, the idea that she has faced so many personal tragedies, even having to go so far as to kill her own brother, you know, that it would make sense that she's the one who is having to find a way to beat back the darkness and keep herself to the light. And the idea that at the end she's the one lighting a candle, it seems like that's maybe the spark of positivity for the future, given the fact that we end the story with Jaina and Jag getting married. Although you have to wonder if the idea basically is not that the dark side is something to be combated so much as the dark side is something she has now triumphed over. She's now lighting a candle. Everything is fine. Is she going from being the sword of the Jedi to the Nerf baseball bat of the Jedi?
Or maybe she's just igniting her lightsaber. She's the lightsaber sword of the Jedi. Now, you know, it's just one of those things that when I saw it, I was like, oh, and it totally took me a moment and I had to perplex it and ponder it and dwell into it and... Now I'm over it. Now, we've got 9 hardcover books here, you know, and this is the second 9-book series, and we've heard now from Del Rey that they're probably not going to do another large series like this. 3 different authors tackled it, just like the last one. We had Outcast, Omen, Abyss, Backlash, Allies, Vortex, Conviction, Ascension, and Apocalypse. Now, again, we're only up to Vortex in the paperback, so you out there who are only reading it a year and a half later... I feel bad for you for having to wait this long. But it's one of those things, in a nutshell, what was this series about? I'm going to throw it to you, Pete, let you take it first. Nathan, you can bounce in there as you want, and we'll just roll with this.
Okay. Well, the series really, I thought it was going to be one thing when it started. It turned into a whole different thing when it developed. It started out as a sort of odyssey with Luke and Ben retracing Jason's sort of his journey through the different Force using groups that was alluded to before Dark Nest, trying to find answers to why he fell to the dark side. Along the course of the series, they run into 2 groups, well, 1 group and 1 villain, in the Lost Tribe of the Sith and in Abeloth. And it gets kind of wacky with the whole Abeloth storyline as she, you know, co-opts the Lost Tribe and tries to take over the entire galaxy, and of course, the Jedi have to come back and save the day at the end.
Yeah, I have to say that I agree. This whole idea that this story was really about one thing, it's not... I don't know. I'm not sure that I buy that. I think it's really what Pete was saying. It sort of changed tenor as it went along. It started out... Aaron Alston says in his Insider number 132 interview, or the author interview about it, he says, the idea was to do something like Homer's The Odyssey in the Expanded Universe, a voyage through alien vistas and magical lands. And he goes into how it was sort of supposed to be somewhat upbeat, based somewhat on Greek mythology. In fact, we have essentially in Backlash sort of a comparison to the Argonauts visiting the Amazons with what happens with Luke and Ben winding up finding themselves, and Vestara, on Dathomir. And it starts out very much like that, and I think it would have been nice to know that going into it, because we talked in a previous episode about the feel of the series, you know, does it work with the 3 authors switching back and forth and all that kind of stuff. And it just kind of felt like, I don't know, I think early on it sort of did that Odyssey thing, but we needed to know that going into it, that it was meant to be this, okay, they want to find out what's going on, what turned Jason dark. Troy Denning refers to it as the original idea was a father and son galactic odyssey to find out why Jason Solo fell to the dark side. That's the idea that came from Shelley Shapiro and Sue Rostoni when they asked about another 9-book series. And we got that whole, it's supposed to be to find out why Jason turned dark thing, except I don't think any of us really understood that what we were going to see was that lather, rinse, repeat kind of thing of, okay, here's a place. We're going to learn a new skill. Because that's the skill that helped Jason turn further towards his path. But it's not actually the final thing that turned him. So now we got to move on to the next location and the next location. And each place will solve a little bit of a problem and learn a new skill. I don't think there was any sense that that was where we were going. If we had known ahead of time that this was meant to be an Odyssey-style formula, then I think we would have been more accepting of that whole episodic, we're going to go to these strange new lands, meet new cultures, learn new skills type of format. Because we wouldn't have expected something different. But then that, in a sense, once we get to, I really guess the end of Abyss, but especially as we get into Backlash, that formula starts to be derailed and we get a very different story. We get the Lost Tribe of the Sith coming in. We get that more personal tale of the relationship that Christy Golden apparently was the first one to suggest between Ben and Vestara. We get this growing issue with Abeloth, where she's this very nebulous villain. We're not quite sure what she is, what kind of threat she represents, how she ties into the insane Jedi, which seems to be a plot point that kind of came and then just kind of vanished as soon as we knew that she was the cause of it. There was no need to continue pursuing it. And then by the time we get to the end, it's this, the Sith had taken over the Galactic Alliance storyline all of a sudden. And we've had this growing storyline of the slave revolts and such. And then the slave revolts become the way for, among others, Roki Kim to get power. And then, oh, surprise, surprise, boom, Roki Kim, actually Abeloth. And then last book, Abeloth, actually in multiple places at once. Actually godlike, she can see the future. And by the way, she's the mother of father, daughter, and son. And it's just kind of the, what? It felt like this series, it's like they had so many different ideas going into it, all of which could have made for some interesting stories, but they wound up sort of, if the goal is to take separate threads and weave them together into something that feels very cohesive and very well planned, I don't know if it was the pacing or what, but it felt more like what we got were threads. You know, okay, I'm gonna show my big brother side here. My sister used to do these little friendship bracelet things, or whatever you call them, these braided little bracelets. And I remember she used to take like three different colors of thread and lay them out, and you like cross one over the other, then the other across into like the middle of the other two, and you gotta braid it, and then it becomes a bracelet that you wear on your wrist. But it's it's all these different lines. I guess that's just regular braiding. I don't know, but that's what she used to do. It kind of felt like, rather than having it all weaved together where we have the final bracelet look to this, where they're very tightly woven, instead we have something that's like it's partway through the process and they just stopped. There are interweaving elements of all these different plot threads that are going on, but they're not very tightly pulled together. It sort of feels like some of them, instead of getting resolved, get more dropped along the wayside, as if the series has an identity crisis. They don't quite know what they want it to be. And in the process, it winds up sort of unraveling as it hits certain points of the story. I don't know. So to answer your question, what's the story about? A lot of different things, apparently, as opposed to one thing, which I think was the weakness of the series, although it could have been its strength.
It's kind of like the anti-New Jedi Order. I mean, it kind of seems like it took that premise of being its own era. You know, the nine-book series in and of itself was a collection of short stories almost. I mean, at times that's what a lot of these books felt like, because like you said, the interweaving thread factor of it, you really did kind of feel like, you know, when you would get to Aaron's book, you know, you would have certain characters that were kind of a little more prominent. Then you got to Christie's and she would deal with certain relationships more than the others. And then you get to Troy, and Troy, he would do his whole thing with the cliques and kind of bring the history part in. You know, and then at the end, he would just, you know, blow your brains out with the Clone Wars adage. And you're just like, what? Like you said, Nathan, I was just one of those like, holy cow, are we really going there? I mean, that was one of the things I think for me that I kept coming back to is how much of this was planned. I mean, I remember when New Jedi Order came out, you know, we were told, well, this was planned, and we had George come in with this, and then that was thrown out. And when we get to the end of Apocalypse, that's when I kept scratching my head and going, does George know we're doing this? And I kept thinking, Mr. Denning, please tell me somewhere, somehow you got some approval for what you're doing, because otherwise this is going to backlash in our face harder than the book backlash did.
Well, let's look at this logically. What do you guys think? The first book, Outcast, came out in March of 2009. We didn't get the Mortis trilogy until last season in the Clone Wars. How much of this could they possibly have known when they were planning the series?
Ding, ding, ding. I've got the answer. I've got the answer. As I stand up and raise my hand like the kids that I usually don't have in class. None. Not a zip, zero, zilch. They flat out say it in the interview, and we've discussed this a little bit before, where they're talking about the background of Abeloth. I think this bears a bit of quoting here. When the question was asked in that insider interview, let's talk about the origin of Abeloth. How much of her creation is attributable to Luke's status as far as Luke's strength? And Christy Golden answers, with someone as powerful as Luke, you have two angles you can use to make things interesting. One is to figure out worthy foes, and yes, Abeloth was created as someone, something, that could really offer a challenge. And she incorporates my second angle, hit Luke where it hurts, which is his good heart. Luke cares very deeply, though not recklessly, and one of the ways to hurt or weaken him is to attack someone he really loves. The hurt of discovering Abeloth was using Callista made her uniquely villainous. Then Troy Denning adds, and this I think is where we kind of slap our foreheads, "We created her because we needed something mysterious and ancient, something that would tempt the Sith and create some major turmoil without being another war." You know, so I guess that sort of makes sense with how in Apocalypse it's essentially, it's happening while the citizens of the Republic aren't quite sure what's happening. It's kind of all behind the scenes. It felt like a war because of where we were, but I guess to the rest of the galactic citizens, it really wasn't. But we started with the idea of an entity that was, in fact, a nexus of dark side power. From there, we knew she would be involved with the Celestials somehow, and I gave her a Cthuloid flavor, if I'm pronouncing that right, when I introduced her in Abyss. Yeah, we're introducing the main villain of the series 3 books in, out of 9. Then the Mortis episodes of Star Wars The Clone Wars came along, and we realized that she would need to fit in with that mythology, and I have to say that Dave Filoni was great about helping us make that work. Now, he said in subsequent interviews that this was something that did come up as Mortis was being devised, like they were going through the process of getting things bounced back and forth with Leland Chi, who was also hearing things from Filoni, and they kind of found a way to make this all fit. It was at least prior to the episodes airing, but again, they did not have exactly who she was planned out from the beginning, which begs the question, I think. Mark, you mentioned how the New Jedi Order was so tightly woven, tightly planned. I gotta wonder if what they've done here is maybe they just felt like the New Jedi Order was too tightly planned. We talked about, you know, is it better to have shorter series or longer series? It kind of feels like as they've moved along with these longer series, each time it's less tightly planned. It's more like, you know, New Jedi Order, this much be done in this book because this many months have passed, and here's these 19 books, they must all connect, here's the time frame for everything. Kind of like what they did with the Clone Wars before the cartoon series. Yeah. And then with Legacy of the Force, it was more like, here's where we go, but each author took it off in their own different direction with their preferred characters, their preferred take on things. Kind of like watching a TV show where different writers for the series will tend to focus on different characters episode to episode, but you still get the broader story as you watch the whole season. And this time it seems much more like, you know, here's one or two bullet points that must be hit in this book. Otherwise, go with it. You know, we'll collaborate from time to time and make sure that the characterizations kind of connect together, that the feel is very uniform. And like I've said before, not necessarily meaning in a bad way, but it's somewhat an interchangeable writer series. I know I didn't see much difference between the writing styles of each one, but it very much seemed like it was here's these two points we got to hit. And now we're going to sort of swirl all this other story around it. And the next author will pick up on one or two threads, but they've got to make sure they hit their couple of bullet points before the next book that hits the couple of bullet points. And in a sense, this series is a series of a relatively small number of specific bullet points that seem like they must have been planned ahead to make this all work, and a whole lot of improvisation along the way. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what it seems like.
I don't think you're wrong to feel that way. I mean, it's definitely how I come across. You know, we had also in the previous episode mentioned the trilogy of trilogies. And in that regard, you know, if you look at it like that, at the end of the first trilogy, that's when we find out who Ablith is. We finally get a name to the big bad. I will admit that by that point, I was banging my head against the desk going, what is going on? I mean, I was hooked. I wanted to know. I was kind of getting irritated because it took me 3 books and I'm still like, I still have a question from the first book I need answered. And they drug that on for a very long time. But, you know, you have to wonder, though, like with Ablith, the fact that she's the mother yet wasn't. I mean, you know, the whole celestial tie-in. I mean, it's like, did they keep her separated from the father and the daughter and the son because she wasn't fully approved by Lucas? I mean, had she maybe been, again, I'm speculating here. I don't know if George knew one way or the other, but I kind of think that if he did, he would give it a full on stamp. Like, oh, she was the mother. She was gone because of some other reason kind of thing. You know, it just seems to me like it's just one of those things where, you know, they rolled the dice and took a chance. And it definitely felt that way throughout the series, especially with the cyclical nature of certain things that we kept seeing happen again. We had like 3 raids on the Jedi Temple, maybe 4. It was like, wow, here we go again. But it worked. They did it well enough that I still enjoyed it. I was still asking myself questions. I wanted to know more. The crazy Jedi aspect, I was really intrigued with where they were going with that. And then they flip-flopped on it. And I felt like there was a lot of flip-flopping. You know, like you mentioned, had we known it was the Odyssey from the start, maybe that would have been different. But I really felt like going in, it was more about what Jason did. I really thought this series was going to give a justification to Jason, and it kind of did if you want to squint and look at it from an Obi-Wan perspective. But there was a lot of flip-flopping going on for me, and that, I think, was the problem I had with the series overall. Aside from that, you know, it wasn't a bad series. I really enjoyed it.
I generally like the series overall as well. I enjoyed it a lot. But I almost feel like they should have taken Abeloth out of the series. I think it would have worked much better, like, story-wise and planning-wise, if they had just kept it with the Odyssey and then the Lost Tribe of the Sith being the main villain in the thing. And you, if you want to use Abeloth as a character, I think she would work better in like a standalone novel as like the villain of a Luke and Ben standalone novel. But I think there's just too much going on and too many loose ends to try to tie up, and it didn't feel like it fit very well at the end.
Well, yeah, loose ends especially. I mean, like Nathan said, she's a character that can be in multiple bodies at multiple times across vast amounts of space. Are we really to believe that the only body she is possessed we're looking at? I mean, I'd take Yoda and stick him off on Dagobah and just, you know, shrink wrap him up, leave him there, and have you know, hedge my bets. I would have, you know, she, especially once you've got Callista. And I love that touch, though. The fact that she killed Luke's ex-girlfriend, that people were like, well, Mara's dead. Maybe Callista will have a shot. Maybe that's how Cade came to be, because we don't know if Cade's actually Ben's kid or Luke's other kid, because they haven't said it. You know, there's a shipper out there. There's one of you out there. I know it.
No, what they would need to do is just have her be in a body that's not so much like Yoda, you know, because Yoda could get old and die. We saw him die from old age. When 904 or whatever it is years old you reach, look as dead you will not. But I think maybe do something like a Darth Krayt. You know, have another body and have it in stasis. I mean, that raises the question of what would that be like? I mean, for the rest of her, does that mean like a sinus headache constantly, like a buzzing in the back of her mind? But, you know, I will say I enjoyed the series generally as well. I think the individual books were well executed most of the time. I enjoyed them, especially once we hit Backlash. I enjoyed pretty much every book in the series, starting with Backlash, with the other ones being a little more iffy. But I think part of that is the pacing of it. I think the pacing of the actual novels themselves doesn't work very well. You have some serious issues with, you know, when do we finally introduce the Lost Tribe of the Sith? When does Abeloth finally become an issue? When do we learn anything about Abeloth? At what point do we just stop caring about Jason's journey in most respects? I mean, there's all kinds of little bits in there where you're like, what? You know, what, how are we going to make the slave thing the big plot line for these books, or a big plot line, and then here it's going to disappear here? Did we really close it up? Were we planning on stretching it out more? There's all kinds of issues I have with the pacing of the series if you were to just read all 9 books straight through. I think it would feel really freaking bizarre. But for better or worse, we got a chance to read these individually because they were so spread out in terms of actual publication. So each book could feel fulfilling and exciting, and yet at the same time, looking back on it as a whole, there's the head scratching. And the loose ends, some of the loose ends do leave a lot of room to be explored. Maybe there's more slave revolts going on. I love the idea, to a degree at least, of I'm not crazy about it, you know, like, oh, but it's a cool idea to have Abeloth still be a threat out there that they could explore in the future. They got some cool stuff going on that they could build on. But what I mean by the time frames here, we've talked about how long it took between some of these books and how they said that they were going to go back and layer in more subplots because they didn't feel like the fans were liking where the first books were going without them. You had Outcast and then waited 3 months for Omen, then 2 months for Abyss, then 6 months for Backlash, 2 months for Allies, 6 months again for Vortex, 6 months again for Conviction, 3 months for Ascension, and 7 months for Apocalypse. That is an insane amount of time to stretch out a 9-book series, although I wonder if part of that was perhaps dictated by the fact that these are all hardbacks. And if you hammer people with hardbacks a couple months in a row repeatedly, there's going to be that backlash, no pun intended, to perhaps the price tag on these things. You might see people more waiting for, say, paperbacks, doing the ebook purchases where it's a little bit cheaper. I don't quite know all of what went into it. I know there was a layering. I know there was a level of, you know, how do we fit it into the publishing schedule and everything. But it seems as though pacing was this series's, to a degree, saving grace to make us feel like each book was almost separate. But at the same time, pacing within the story was perhaps its biggest downfall. But, you know, if you could read it bit by bit, not read it all straight through, I think the average Star Wars reader could enjoy it.
I have trouble when it's 3 years from the beginning of a series to an ending of a series. unless it's like something like the New Jedi Order, which was just this massive thing with lots of smaller stories in it. In Fate of the Jedi, it's largely one overarching story, even though it goes in a bunch of weird directions. But 3 years is just too long for me to wait for the resolution of a story. It drives me nuts.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Another thing that kind of drove me nuts was the Krayt factor. I mean, was at the end of Apocalypse, was the mysterious person, the man on the throne that caused Jason to set everything in motion, was it Lord Krayt? I mean, I say yes, but even Denning doesn't know. And that just that bothers me. I have to admit it. It bothers me. How can you not know? I mean, how can you write the details that you wrote and not know? I mean, really?
Is there a Star Wars equivalent of the middle finger? Because in a sense, isn't that basically what Krayt could do now? Being like, wow, Jason Solo turned to the dark side, essentially conquered the Galactic Republic from the inside, instigated this massive civil war, and then the search for the answers about him led to Avaloth and the Galactic Alliance being taken over yet again. And yeah, if I'm the dark man, I'm still out there. Big old middle fingers to you. Guess what's coming a few decades down the line? Toodles. You know, it's just, he's sort of like this, if he really is the mustache twirling villain in the background that everyone's trying to catch, it's like they caught everybody but who they needed to catch. Yes, Avaloth was a bigger threat, but Avaloth wasn't the threat that Jason was going after, unless the thought was that Avaloth was going to be possessing Krayt or something within the vision that he had. It's like they sort of got sidetracked, not just from Jason's journey, but once they get a sense of what Jason's journey was all about and what he found at the end of it that changed him, they then got derailed from that and left that kind of hanging out there, presumably for a loose thread for later, but it's still, again, weird. They kept changing the targets. It's like, it's the old joke, and I know somebody's gonna, you know, I'm not meaning this in a political sort of way, but it was a joke that was told by Jimmy Kimmel at the White House Correspondents' Dinner after President Obama was up there joking about himself plenty when he introduced himself with, my family was from such and such, and he kind of gave the, I myself was born in Hawaii, and he does a little wink and that sort of thing. But Jimmy Kimmel made a comment about President Obama is a family man. It's great. I love to see how he takes the time to go to his daughter's soccer games and move the goalposts. And that's kind of like the joke in politics. You always move the target of what you're trying to get. Oh, you can't get this passed? Well, change the way you talk about it. And now this thing that really wasn't your goal in the first place, now you can say this is a big political victory. And that's kind of what the Jedi did throughout this series. It's like the goalposts kept changing. What are they trying to do? Who are they trying to stop? What are they trying to find out? Where is this series supposed to end? And at the end of it, I mean, I guess you could call this a win in a sense. But, I mean, it's almost like it's like I'm going into the store and by God, I'm going to buy a lottery ticket and I'm going to win the lottery. And at the same time, as you're walking out, you buy yourself a carton of Pepsi and you win yourself like a free carton of Pepsi from a code inside the Pepsi box. Yes, I won. I did what I set out to do. What?
Well, the whole Jason plot, the thing that really confused me is at one point we get the impression, well, Jason freed Avaloth because he was crucial in destroying Centerpoint Station in the other series. Oh, okay. And then later we find out, no, Jason freed Avaloth because he flow-walked and changed the future so the Dark Man didn't sit on the throne. So we got to go through this whole book series and fix that. Oh, and by fixing it, the Dark Guy is going to get on the throne in the Legacy comics later. Oh, but wait, we don't know if that's actually Krayt, so maybe it's somebody else that we're going to write about in another book series down the road. We're going to leave it open like that, so we don't know if it's Krayt or not. Wink, wink. Yeah, it's not Palpatine in the Clone Wars. It's the other guy.
But don't worry. We have the Killix who are going to explain everything. The plot, Avaloth, the father, son, and daughter. Everything's going to be explained by the Killix. Of course, they don't really talk in anything that makes sense, and they have no conception of time or space. But it's all good.
But hey, that was the plot, too, that I liked, the whole Raynar thing, and that, you know, at the end of Apocalypse, it's kind of like, oh, and Saba, go bring him back. Oh, okay. She nods and talks into a comm link, and then that whole plot was over and done.
I do like the fact, though, that as much as I'm down on Dark Nest, it really was not a series I was particularly fond of, as we heard previously. I will say that now, at least, Dark Nest, thanks to Denning wrapping his own books, in a sense, into the finale of this series, Darkness has more of a point to it now. Because if you had not had the Killick situation, if you had not had Raynar become a joiner and get essentially rehabilitated throughout previous books in the last series and this series, he would not have been able to get those answers from the Killicks and give us that broader sense of the tapestry of the Celestials and the Ones and all that sort of thing. So I think that in giving more validity to a story than in a lot of ways I found was not one I could easily recommend to anyone, he really did a good job of tying that in. Same thing with the stuff with Mortis. You know, like I said, the series had great points to it. The individual books worked well, and they did a really good job of tying in other stuff. The series itself just sort of felt directionless as it was doing that. But they did a really good job of tying into the broader mythology, and I'm curious if we're going to see any more with that thanks to things like Dawn of the Jedi.
Well, I want to know if the Maw Station, the little base that they have, what was it, Shelter, inside the Maw, if they're going to use that as a new Beyond Shadows platform and do some spirit walking of their own. The whole way that worked was intriguing to me. There were times I didn't like it, but I really liked the Lake of Apparitions. I liked the scenes with the Solo boys and Mara. That actually it appealed to me. But when you got to the end fight, I was kind of scratching my head going, what is going on?
Careful where you walk, you'll step on Mara's face.
So, how did you guys interpret the Lake of Apparitions? Is it the Force Purgatory, or what exactly is going on there?
That's kind of where I saw it. I saw it as the wellspring of the Force, where, you know, kind of like a window into the afterlife or into the Force itself. But I also had the feeling, though, that the space that was going on in there was also distance inside the Maw, because it seemed like by the time Luke walked to the lake, he was actually at the planet when he was, you know, I think he started off in the station and then he did the little walk trip. And the next thing you know, he's on the planet with Ableth, but he was in the Beyond Shadows version of it. I don't know. It had a very physical sense, even though it wasn't physical.
I like the lake idea. I mean, it has a lot of mystical elements, of course, you know, going back to mythology and that sort of thing. But I like the whole concept of it sort of blends real world traditions, like the idea of like a world soul, like you have in, say, Hinduism, with, you know, Star Wars' sense of having, you know, people dying and essentially rejoining the Force. And here, it's almost like we have another interpretation of what we've seen previously with, you know, we have Sith spirits, in a sense, who are sort of distinct from, say, Force ghosts for Jedi. And we have Qui-Gon being able to have the actual vision to Obi-Wan, essentially appearing to Obi-Wan, as with the older version of Ahsoka to herself, assuming it wasn't a trick or anything, on Mortis. We've got Qui-Gon being able to be heard but not seen in the prequel trilogy, After Death. And, of course, we have the Force ghosts that sort of are able to retain their essence, as I sort of mentioned Force ghosts, but the whole issue of essence retention that is developed more within the EU, but something that Yoda starts to reference within the prequel trilogy. It sort of feels like this is yet another of those instances where essentially we're getting a chance to see that glimpse. I would almost say that there's a question of whether or not they are ghosts, like remnants left behind of the individual people, or if they're actually the spirits themselves who are able to talk. But given that they can access memories, hold intelligent conversations and that sort of thing, it seems like this actually must be something that's accessing their actual spirits, not
and hold
something
up
that's,
bodies, as we see with Mara
this
and
is
Luke.
True. This is true. I don't know. I think it's a very interesting thing. The whole idea, the whole setup of that planet for Abeloth is a really cool idea. I would like to see, and you know, it's another thing that I kind of doubt that they do it. I'd love to see maybe something where we have younger Jedi starting to maybe not flow walk, but maybe they walk beyond shadows. And you know, imagine the way that they could use that if it was something like, okay, they walk beyond shadows, and you know, as you walk, you know, your body starts to sort of atrophy because you know you're not in it. You can't be gone too long. Think of it as like, essentially a drug. I mean, they sort of already ran with some of the whole drug use parallels within this series. But imagine young Jedi trying to do it as they learn these perhaps forbidden secrets. I mean, that could be a whole nother realm of being able to bring that later generation of Jedi who seem to have been forgotten about a lot of the time in these series, because we keep focusing on the big three, bring those into the foreground and give them a challenge that essentially is part of youth and indiscretion, as opposed to being something that's some thing of galactic importance. It could be a much more personal story if they could use that in that sort of way.
Now, wasn't the Font of Power a physical place on Abla's planet as well as in Beyond Shadows?
Weren't essentially, wasn't essentially everything except, except the Lake of Apparitions. I thought all of it, if I remember correctly, had some physical manifestation in the real world, not just Beyond Shadows. Maybe I'm getting confused.
No, that was how I felt it was, too. It was the planet had everything as well. Because it seemed like they'd started out on the station, and the trip that they took, you know, seemed to be, at least that's how I interpreted it, was them traveling from the space station out of their bodies and across to where the planet was. And then all the action Beyond Shadows happened on the planet, but they didn't realize they were on the planet. At least that's how I kind of gathered it. But I don't think we ever saw anything like with the Force Ghosts and stuff like that happening in the physical realm. It all happened Beyond Shadows. Whereas the Lake of Apparitions, that was where Kai's first master died. At least that was how I interpreted it. But I definitely got the feeling that you had to be Beyond Shadows to see the spiritual side of what was going on in that lake.
I sort of took it almost as if there's like different dimensions that are just slightly off. And when you're Beyond Shadows, you're able to see what's sort of under the surface in that alternate dimension.
Ooh, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, I have to wonder, though, with the danger of the font itself. I mean, they left that wide open. I mean, we know that by drinking from the font, you, in a sense, create Abloth. And Abloth was trying to turn Ben and Vistara into the basic son and daughter by having them drink from the font. But yet, nowhere did Luke... I mean, you know, you've got this water that anybody who drinks are going to become a crazy evil villain. I mean, what? That's not a weapon of mass destruction, Luke? You're not going to send the Jedi in and cap it? What the heck?
And they go, excuse me, former Chief of State Dala, you don't happen to have any spare Death Stars still sitting around, do you?
Sun Crusher, maybe?
I think one of the other storylines here that I found particularly intriguing, and I mean, it was a major storyline, was the whole Ben and Vistara thing. I mean, it sort of felt somewhat forced early on, because like, oh, here we go. Here's going to be the love interest for Ben. Now it's about time. You know, all of a sudden, he's going to be falling for her. Apparently, he's forgotten about that whole thing where Tahiri was reaching down into his pants back in Legacy of the Force. What? But we've got this whole issue of their growing relationship. I found it interesting that the way that they ended it was not what we would expect, I guess. We assume sort of there were only two outs for this. She was either considered a Sith as part of the Lost Tribe, or she'd go to the Jedi. It was one or the other, or she would wind up finding herself an outcast of one side or the other because of the choice that she made. Either way, it sort of felt like there was that dichotomy of choices there, and yet, thanks to Ship, we have another option, which is, of course, the one Sith. It seemed like that kind of came out of nowhere as far as like, oh, hey, there's these other Sith. Why don't we come join them? Because then you don't have to choose between the other two. But while it did seem like somewhat of a convenient out, it did at least provide a third option. It leaves her out there as someone who is sort of a rogue element. It's kind of like what they're doing with the Clone Wars now, where we've got the issue of, you know, the Jedi and the Sith, and yet now we have Savage and Darth Maul out there, or I guess just Maul, no Darth anymore, I suppose, and they are this extra third element out there, or Ventress being another element out there where it makes things a little more complex. I'm curious to see where they go with that, but then again, how much can Vistara appear in the future without giving away the existence of the one Sith? You know, there's that level of secrecy, but it's not like they haven't sent a bunch of agents out there apparently before, like that, what was he, Anzadi or whatever he was, it was able to completely cloak his presence in the Force or drain the Force of the area or whatever.
Yeah. What the heck? I'm reading that right now. It's like Nat or something like that. But the other thing is she didn't go crawling to them. I mean, Ship lorded her, you know, gave her a lording. She's now a Sith Lord. And he actually said that the one Sith needed her. I mean, she's not going to be going there, you know, head down and cowling. She's going to go there proud because she's needed. They're actually, you know, could use her. I thought that was an interesting touch. It was one I did not see coming. Another couple touches I really liked that I want to hit really fast were Jaina Solo's character development. You know, we watched her become a master in the book, and the way that went down in Apocalypse was awesome. I really look forward to it. In the last episode, I mentioned how much I love the wedding scene at the very end of the book. That also was good. But Tahiri's character was another one that it was fun to watch the ride. There were times where I was like, oh, she's doomed. And then there were other times where I was fist pumping the air going, yes, when she became an Imperial Hand, I was like, oh, the plots that are open and laid out in front of her. And then by the end of the book, I'm like, what do you mean she's not going to stay an Imperial Hand? I was crushed. I was like, finally, a book where we're going to see a first Imperial Knight. I was like thinking this was it. No, I got totally blindsided. And there was a lot of blindsided moments. Not all of them were bad.
I got to agree with Mark. I absolutely loved what. There was times I didn't like the Tahiri story, but Tahiri is one of my favorite characters from the NJO. And I really enjoyed the way they went with her, particularly the scene with Han and Leia when they went to meet her in prison. That was pretty awesome. But it's interesting that they've sort of moved her past that sort of flow-walking junkie slash Jason kind of... Yeah, we're not going to go there. But I don't want to talk about that. I'm blocking that entire part of that series out. But it's interesting. She's sort of set up as a whole character again, where she can actually take a story and run with it and do something else with her instead of just sort of being the, oh, poor me. I miss my boyfriend.
Yeah, and it was touching, too, in a lot of ways, because you actually saw that even though Anakin and her relationship didn't go beyond where it did, that she still is a part of the Solo family. I mean, you really felt that. I mean, it was the way that they wrote the character interactions between her and the Solo family during the trial, after the trial, leading up to, and then seeing what, you know, that what Jagged Fel was willing to do to help her out. I found that was my favorite part, was once Tahiri was on Jagged's ship, and then once he gave her the Imperial Hand status, I'm like, yes! And the fact that the guy down on the one planet, when she showed him her identification, paled, I loved it. I was like, that's so awesome. It's so Mara Jade.
It worked really well in a lot of ways when they did anything with those personal relationships. They got the relationships in a lot of ways right. The Jaina stuff with Han and Leia was a little iffy at times, but they did a really good job, for instance, with Ben's frustration, Vistara's frustration, when she finally does decide to join the Jedi, albeit briefly before she makes that horrible mistake, you could call it choice mistake, at the end of the book. I forget which book it was off the top of my head. Where she winds up essentially sacrificing another Jedi to save Ben. I mean, I really kind of was like, yes, whenever she looked like she was finally making that jump and had that sort of tender moment with Ben. And then I really was feeling the, oh, no, kind of moment. Like, I really sort of felt that kick in the gut when she made the decision that made her realize that she would not be able to be, you know, what she wanted to be. For Tahiri, I mean, her story worked well. I mean, it's kind of cool to see her transform, see her finally in a major role here on her own, and then with Boba Fett going after one of the Abalos. She sort of felt like she was like a fifth wheel a lot of times in stories now, at least earlier in this series. Now she really gets a chance to be a big part of it. I do think that I was a little shocked that we didn't see nearly as much with her trial convention or conviction, et cetera, et cetera. I was waiting to see something where there was some kind of big escape, not with them trying to break out Dala, and then she happens to be able to tag along. You know, I was waiting for one of those Three Musketeers Disney movie moments, you know, where a Jedi comes up, like Aramis, I guess, Charlie Sheen, you know, or whoever it is. Don't worry, we are with you, all for one and one for all. And then, you know, some big, you know, huge, you know, prison break type thing or execution break type thing that would really have set things off. But I guess they really couldn't have had the Jedi do that because of what it would have meant as far as the way that the Jedi Order looked. But and they had to get her out of there some way. It just sort of felt like one of those, okay, boom, well, she's done, she's convicted, and then boom, she's escaped. Okay, that whole conviction thing, pretty much not an issue anymore. So there were times where her storyline felt rushed because it was sort of like a, oh yeah, Tahiri's still out there. We need to make sure we get her to the next bullet point on the plot point list. I like where she went. Be interesting to see where she goes from here. But again, pacing as a head-scratcher.
Well, another thing I found interesting was the way the Mortis came into the story. It pretty much leaves you with the impression that Anakin Skywalker, the episodes in Mortis, is the reason that the Force became out of balance. And that basically, he wasn't the chosen one in the end. That it was basically Luke and Ben. I mean, granted, it was his offspring, but it basically came around that due to his lack of taking the father's position, he created the imbalance. I was just like, whoa. I was really expecting a lot of backlash with that.
Well, you know, it would have helped if Lucas was consistent on what the prophecy was supposed to mean. Because in the past, what he had always said before the Mortis trilogy, in the few interviews he gave about it, in talking about the prophecy in that Bill Moyers interview and all this kind of stuff, when he did talk about the philosophy behind the Chosen One prophecy, he doesn't refer to it being balance as in, like, say, two Jedi, two Sith, as some people have taken it to be, or the idea of balance as in there is no good, no evil, it's all wiped out. You know, both sides are taken down, or both sides are of equal power. He referred to it as the natural state of the universe being good, being positive, and essentially that the dark side was like a cancer eating at it, and so bringing balance to the Force was more like healing the universe. It was a matter of wiping out evil. Because by wiping out evil, you bring the balance of the Force back to its natural state, which is predominantly positive. And then the Mortis trilogy aired. And goodbye to all that stuff. And we either have multiple interpretations of the prophecy, or now we have a completely different prophecy, or we just tossed out the old interpretation. And the whole idea of Vader being able to bring balance to the Force by vanquishing the Emperor and redeeming himself, thereby leaving no more Sith Lords, at least, you know, not counting EU stuff, Lumaya, etc., but from a film standpoint, being able to wipe that slate clean, that idea of balance no longer makes sense within the context of the Mortis trilogy, and this series, just, you know, it further ties into the Mortis trilogy. It's adding to continuity. It's interweaving things that do exist and should be acknowledged now, but there is that question of what exactly did balance of the Force even mean? It's sort of like when Yoda says, you know, a prophecy which misread could have been. It kind of makes you think, a prophecy which has all kinds of freaking interpretations could have been, so maybe we shouldn't take as much stock in it, you know? There's so many different ways to look at religious texts. It kind of feels like they're going for that approach now. We're like, oh, so Lucas just completely changed his mind on what it meant and kind of undermined the ending of Return of the Jedi on himself. Okay, we're going to go for the whole, there's all these lenses of truth, and we're going to apply it to the prophecy, too.
Yeah, we're going to just apply a couple lenses with that. Another plot that I really enjoyed was the Horn story. I'm a huge Corran Horn fan. And, you know, seeing his kids come down with the cuckoo virus, also Aboleth possession, if you want to call it what it is, it bothered me at first. I was really worried what they were going to do with the characters. But by the time Apocalypse came around, we finally got what I had been waiting for from probably Vortex on. And Corran finally played a large part in the story, as did his kids to a degree. And I really like the fact that we had that kind of closure for that character. You know, there was a lot of character-driven stories that happened in the middle of this nine-book series. And I want to say that was what was successful about it all the way around, because it gave you a feeling that there were more stories being told than just the nine you got. And I really enjoyed that. I really appreciated that. You know, some people will say that there were apologies here and there in the plot developments. Call it what you will. You know, if you liked it, you liked it. If you didn't, you didn't.
In addition to the plot with the horns, I thought it was nice that we got some more development with Tenel Ka and Alana. And it was good to see Tenel Ka leave the Hapes consortium for a little while and get out into the larger galaxy and sort of push this sort of Jedi queen into the forefront.
That's another character that I really liked how they played, especially Denning, when he would look at Tanelka from Alana's eyes, and you knew you're never going to see her really welding a lightsaber again and going crazy unless, you know, the poodoo's really hit the fan. And I know a lot of fans out there that they were really upset that her character went that way, because it kind of took her out of what, from the Young Jedi Knight books, the way she was. But I really love the play up between mother and daughter and the way the character development and the fact that Alana finally came out in it as it was, hey, I'm not Amelia. You know, some people knew it. But her story played in well, too. I mean, we had at the end with the Barabels and her knowing about the nest and all that, and with Marv, was it Marv or Barv? When his characters came to an end, the way it impacted her, I was just, I mean, I felt like that scene could have been wrote a little better just to really tear me up. It didn't tear me up as much as I felt like it could have, but it definitely did a lot for her character, and I'm really looking forward to where they go with the character. I mean, my daughter right now was the same age, so when I was reading the book, and anytime I was like, she was random, oh, come check this out, this girl's your age, I was reading it to her, she got a kick out of the character. And for me, as a dad, that's something I love. When my kids see something in the books, too, and they're like, yeah, I want to know more about it. It's the hook, man. You got to hook them, especially while they're young.
And I thought they did a very good job keeping Alana interesting and intelligent and active, but not making her seem like a 30-year-old in like a little kid's body. There was still enough that made her a kid, but it was just developed enough that you are starting to get attached to the character. They're setting her up for future books and future series.
I got to say, though, and this is something that, I mean, this is me because I'm not, I don't raise children. I educate children, but I mean, all the kids that I see are 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, okay? I'm sort of in this situation where I'm only seeing certain ages, and I have had experience in, say, dating people who have had kids, but they always tended to be the kids, at least, not the women, the kids, between ages like 3, 4, 5-ish, okay? So I have a very hard time when reading any of the Star Wars books, whether we're talking the earlier stuff, this stuff, whatever, anytime that they use the kids, and the kids are not of teen age, like, say, in Young Jedi Knights, I have a very hard time getting my brain around how old they're supposed to be, how mature they're supposed to be able to act or not be able to act, whether or not their dialogue really is befitting their age or their education level at that age. For me, it's a very hard thing to grasp onto. They did a really good job with Alana here, but I will say a lot of times I had to step back and remind myself, okay, wait, how old is she supposed to be? Because for me, it's just a very hard thing to conceptualize. I don't know why.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I think about Jason Solo in Jedi Academy trilogy. When he's sitting there and he's fighting off Exar Kun's spirits that he's sending after Luke's body, and he's got his uncle's lightsaber. I mean, granted, I think Luke was kind of helping him out, but it was one of those things where I was like, man, I just don't see that kid doing that. He's only 2. All right, so that's about going to wrap up our episode. We're going to do a quick ranking, a one-word wrap-up with 1 through 10, 10 being best. Okay, Pete, you're the guest, so you have the guest honors.
One word to sum up this series. Tentacles. Both in terms of the story and in terms of the future possibilities for the EU. And I'd probably give the series about a 7. It was solid, but there were some ups and downs.
Ooh, I like that word, tentacles. Nathan, what about you?
I'm going to give it, I would say, a 6 or 7. And if there's one word I would pick for it, particularly early on, it would be meandering.
Interesting. I, too, am going to give it a 7. I felt it was better than average. It wasn't one of the best series, but it definitely had a lot going on overall. And by overall, I don't mean just the 9 books itself, but to the overall saga, both forward and backwards. It had a lot going in each direction that appeals to me. My one word I'm going to have to say is Odyssey, because it did feel like that. Once they explained it to me, it kind of fit in, was like a little clicking of the locks. The tumblers all went, the safe opened. Oh, hey, there's a pot of gold in here. Star Wars books. And once I kind of figured that out, you know, I look back on what was confusing for me at the beginning of the series, and it makes a lot more sense. And I think that anybody who wants to check the series out, it will be a fun odyssey for you. That about wraps up this episode of Star Wars Beyond the Films. Remember, you can find our show at www.starwarsreport.com, as well as our Facebook page, iTunes, Zune, and airing on Middle Earth Network Radio. If you like our show, be sure to drop us a review on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. You can also fire us off an email. If you email us, be sure to send it to beyondthefilms@starwarsfanworks.com. Be sure to also interact with us on Facebook and Twitter at SW Beyond Films. So once again, this has been Mark Herleman.
And Nathan Butler.
And Peter.
Yes, Peter Morrison, our special guest. Thank you once again, man, for coming on. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me on, guys. And if the listeners would like, they can check me out at lightsaberrattling.com or on Facebook as Lightsaber Rattling as well.
Yes, great man, great Twitterer. Be sure to follow. Thanks again for listening, and may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds. Maybe I should have changed my one word to what? I'm just saying. thank goodness it's over, and we didn't even wind up doing anything with First Blood or Imprint or any of that, or that Millennium Falcon quasi tie-in stuff.
There's a lot going on in that series. I mean, you know, there were so many things that we still missed that you just can't get to in an hour.
It's like, my mom makes this great chili, right? And my stepmom makes a really good chili, too. She's got noodles and stuff, and it's kind of like an Italian-style chili. They both make really good chili, okay? I can try it with all the same ingredients, following all the same instructions. It never quite tastes as good as it should, you know? It kind of is like what's happened here. I mean, all the ingredients were there, but it just didn't quite taste like what Mama used to make. It didn't taste like Legacy of the Force or New Jedi Order. I guess.
I like that.
There's a little bit. There's not enough chili powder up in there.
You needed more bearable eggs.
Not enough cayenne.
Oh, don't even get me started on that whole Barabel side story. We're going to stretch a side story through all 9 books. One of the few side stories that'll stretch through pretty much all 9 books, or almost all 9 books, and it's going to turn out to be just a convenient way to make sure the Barabels are there for the end of the story.
Yeah.
Really? You can
call that a slaughter point.
We call that planning ahead. Maybe Abeloth should have gotten that much planning ahead.
You know, I just finally got to look through the Essential Guide to Warfare and saw the picture they had of Abeloth in there. And I was thinking to myself, why couldn't they have dropped that, like, book number 3 when we first saw her? So I had an idea what she frickin' looked like.
Go gadget tentacles.
The one thing I really loved about Abeloth was that one scene when she was aboard ship. I can't remember which book it was in. When she was, like, melted in a puddle. And it was just like, there was a body part here, body part there. It's Abeloth soup.
Bum-bum-bum-bum-bum.
Right. I just kind of felt like, you know, it reminded me, and of course...
Abeloth, get into the ship!
Well, yeah, you want to go back to the franchises here. I mean, I kept laughing. Somebody made the joke, and I forget who it was, that she really befits the name of the old James Bond woman, right? Octopus. Because she's a woman who essentially is, like, Octopus Lady. You know?
Well, I kept thinking of the face stealer from Avatar. Look, Aang, run! Oh, Luke, run!
I was just waiting for her to spit ink. Be like, I'm done. I'm done. The Gungans can spit or snot out something that will fix a broken helmet. She's an octopus lady spitting ink. I'm done. I can deal with Dak, Mon Calamari, Mon Cala, but no, I'm done.
That's it. I'm shutting down FanWorks. I'm out.
What would you call that even in the Star Wars universe? You know? Oh no, her hands are turning into tentacles. Golly, they kind of look like Quarren faces. Is that more insulting to her or to the Quarren?
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, your face very much resembles Abeloth's hands. That's it. I'm cutting my tentacles off tonight.
You guys are blessed. You've got Abeloth hands on your chin. I want to be like you.
Wow.
Cue the vong. For only 9 shillings, we can make that happen.
Don't worry, we don't have to reference it in future books. We just can change it right now. You can change back and all that scarring stuff. You know, the internal and external, don't worry about it. Nobody will notice it in the future, as long as you slip your hands down the Jedi Master's kid's pants.
There was a moment there in Apocalypse when everything's crumbling and they're talking about the Vong understructure. I'm like, yes, it's still there. Oh, no, it's all burning in lava now. Bye, Vong structure.
Melted world brain.
Yeah.
Nice. I think you can get that as a sandwich at some street festivals.
Well of the world brain. Try our well of the world brain soup.
Nice. Now, do you think that when they do deal with things like you mentioned Tennelle Kaa coming back, you don't see her kicking butt. Now that she doesn't really kick butt because she's a queen and she's basically got only the one appendage to hold the lightsaber in, do you think that they gave her the same little or something similar to the entry for the updated Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Do you think they just call her mostly armless?
Oh. That's rough.
Yeah. I always thought, you know, in the New Jedi Order, that would have been the perfect time to give her the replacement arm. A big middle finger to the Vong. Come at me, you scallywags! I got two arms now. Watch what I can do.
Or give her a Vong arm, but it's held on by cybernetic prosthesis. So it's kind of like oh yeah, I've used your technology and I'm blaspheming it right now.
Or even better, just give her a giant light saw as a arm.
Spinning around all Optimus Prime style.
And go gadget lightsaber.
Which was it? Was KOTOR 2 the mechanic that had the arm that had the repulsor holding it on? A little Vong claw held on that way.
Just don't let her become emotionally disturbed, because apparently that will cause the arm to turn into spider legs.
It's like, I'm done, I'm out.
All of a sudden, her shoulder starts talking like Sam Witwer. What's going on here? Like, too bad from the old Masters of the Universe here.
When Dave called me and told me he wanted me to voice her arm, I was so excited, I almost crashed my car.
Yeah, exactly.
What's that other tentacle coming up over your shoulder? That's my confidence.